Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, joined as ever by Lahav Harkov. Lahav, did you have a chance to watch Saturday Night Live this past Motzei Shabbat, this past Saturday night?
So I don't think Saturday Night Live has been funny in a really long time. Mm-hmm. So I can't say that I usually watch it.
But it's usually not anti-Semitic, though.
No, but I don't really think it is this time either. So I watched Dave Chappelle's monologue from the intro, which all of Jewish Twitter is talking about.
I denounce anti-Semitism in all its forms. And I stand with my friends in the Jewish community. And that, Kanye, is how you buy yourself some time.
He was talking about anti-Semitic ideas and criticizing the people who were promoting them. That was how I saw what he was saying. And a lot of other people think that, like, no, he's giving these ideas too much airtime.
I think he was giving them a lot of airtime, and he was making light of it. You know, like, he read that note in the beginning, you know, I'm against anti-Semitism, I stand by my Jewish friends, and now let's go have a laugh of the whole thing. It's not necessarily something to laugh about.
But he's a comedian who loves to touch on hot button issues, and like, his past few comedy specials on Netflix, like, he's been talking about the transgender issue, and he's also talked about, like, violence against Asians in the U.S., which was going on during the pandemic, like, in the beginning of the pandemic especially, and that it was a lot of Black on Asian violence, and, like, his wife is Asian. I don't think he hates Asians, but he makes these hot button jokes, and I just felt like he was not praising Kanye or Kyrie Irving. In fact, I have to say that the moment that made me laugh the most, actually, is when he accused Kyrie Irving of being a Holocaust denier, because it was like, I've never heard a funny joke about Holocaust denial in my life. And I thought it was, I mean, I'm not going to, like, repeat the joke because I'm not going to do it justice, but I thought he was very funny in that moment. It wasn't such a funny monologue in general. It was like, but that part made me laugh.
I just think that it's normalizing and popularizing anti-Semitism to an extent. And at a time that Jewish sensitivities are already being kind of pushed aside, and you have people like Kanye and Candace Owens from the Daily Wire and all these other people who are kind of trying to normalize this language.
Yeah.
Here comes a very famous comedian on a very prominent primetime TV show and makes light of it. So to me, I mean, I don't think he's an anti-Semite, right? Don't get me wrong, but I do think is that it's normalizing this type of rhetoric, and that's not what's needed right now.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, it's like, I thought when people wanted to cancel him for saying things about transgender people that, like, he should be allowed to make jokes. And I just differentiate between this and, say, like, Candace Owens, who takes herself very seriously as a commentator on politics and culture. And, you know, like, it's like a different, to me, it's a different context. And the other thing I kept thinking about was, you know, one of his first movies, maybe even his first movie, was a Mel Brooks movie. And I just couldn't help thinking, like, you know, he learned how to make jokes about Jews from the master. I don't think he's as funny as Mel Brooks, at least not. He wasn't this week. But I just think he's someone who sort of subscribes to the idea that you can joke about everything. And that, especially when people are like, no, don't joke about this, like, he comes out and jokes about it. And
that's
some people
invitation.
Are only paying. Right. And some people are only paying attention to it now because it's about Jews, because that's fine. Like, I don't need every Jewish person to watch all of Chappelle's comedy specials. But this is how he's been always.
I did see one tweet, which I thought was, you know, kind of like what you spoke about, that someone tweeted that, thank you, basically pretty much thank you to the Jews, because you got Dave Chappelle to talk for a long time about the Jewish people and not about transgender. So, you
know, right.
It's really, yeah, we appreciate the sacrifice.
Yeah. So another response to anti-Semitism that we saw this week is from Israeli pop star Noah Kirel. Do you see that?
Yes, her dress or outfit or whatever it was that she was wearing.
Yeah, it was bizarre. She was at the MTV Europe Awards or whatever. She was like Israel's candidate for Pop Singer of the Year, and has been, I think, for like 5 years or something, I saw. But anyway, she was wearing pants that had Kanye West's face all over them, and then looked like he was wearing like a Jewish star necklace. which I thought was a very strange way to make a statement about Kanye West.
I thought it was a strange outfit also.
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's ugly.
Then again, I mean, I'm not exactly some fashion master. And there were gloves, Lahav. Don't forget the gloves. Also Kanye's
yeah,
face.
Yeah, so she
them.
Had like these like, yeah, like Magenta bead necklaces sort of all strewn all over her outfit. It was a really weird. And the funny thing is like, right, like Kanye and Kyrie Irving have both been saying this thing that like black people are the real Jews. So you're putting a Magenta bead necklace on a black guy who claims he's the real Jew. Like, okay.
You know, I wonder how people looked at it though. Is it support of Kanye? Is it against Kanye?
I mean, she said, or the designer said, I don't remember the exact details, that it is against Kanye, that she was making a statement against him. But I don't know that if somebody saw her, that that's what they would think.
Right. They might say, oh, he's a friend to the Jewish people. Look at that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if that's what's going to beat Kanye, right? I mean, it's a nice grab at attention. And
I have to say, and it's not something I say very often, I think Miri Regev did this kind of thing better, wearing her politics on her clothes. A few years ago, she was culture minister. She went to the Cannes Film Festival. Yeah, and she wore a dress that had the Jerusalem skyline across the skirt. And it was not subtle, but looked a lot nicer than this.
I think so, too. Wow, this is like, I think we just made history, Lav. We said something positive about Miri Regev on the podcast. This one will go down in history.
We can say positive things about her. I mean,
I would find it hard. Yes.
Okay. I don't love her attitude, but she's done good things.
Yeah. Maybe one day we'll talk about what those good things are. But let's talk a little about Itamar Ben-Gvir, far right politician. He's angling for the public security ministry. He's going to become the minister of police. Bezalel Smotrich, the head of the Religious Zionist Party, is becoming, what seems like as we speak, and as we're recording this, probably the defense minister, maybe the finance minister. Aryeh Deri becoming the head of Shas, becoming the finance minister if Smotrich goes to the defense. It's shaping up to be quite the cabinet for Benjamin Netanyahu here.
And there's battles within Likud about who gets which cabinet posts also. There's the foreign ministry. There's talk that Ron Dermer, the former ambassador of the U.S., wants it. You wrote an interesting column about Dermer for Friday's paper. Right. But there's talk that he has asked Netanyahu for it. But it's not so clear that Netanyahu, like, politically will be able to give such a senior post to someone who's not actually a Knesset member. Even though, I mean, he's certainly more qualified than anyone in Likud. And then for the justice ministry, Yariv Levine really wants it. And he's sort of he has been the engine behind the right becoming so focused on judicial issues. Yeah. I mean, it really, really spiked when, you know, when the Netanyahu investigations came through and Netanyahu was indicted. But like, Levine has been on this for 10 years more. I think he got into the Knesset in 2009.
I think, you know, what people often say about Netanyahu, longtime Netanyahu observers, is that for years, right, he was against all this stuff. He didn't want to make these reforms. And
Yariv Levine was talking about this when Netanyahu didn't like it. Exactly.
Correct. Now that Netanyahu's on trial, suddenly he is interested in these reforms. Even Aaron Barak, the longtime, very prominent Supreme Court president here in Israel, had said in the past that Netanyahu was one of the greatest defenders of the court, likely referring to those attempts by members of his own party to try to undermine the court.
Well, it's interesting because it's not just coming from within his party. For a while, it was coming from within his party, and Netanyahu could fairly easily block that. But now his coalition partners want it too, all of his coalition partners. And they each have their own sort of, you know, reasons that are not necessarily related to the trial.
I'm curious, though, you know, because you do cover the diplomatic beat for us. When you think of the makeup of this government and how it's shaping to be, what is the world going to say if you have Smotrich in defense, Ben-Gvir at the police ministry, Deri, a convicted criminal twice at finance? What is the world's reaction going to be when they're looking at this government?
Okay, so first of all, I don't think the world's going to care that much about Derry's convictions. Like, that's like going to be a non-issue. I think the issue is more that Deri has like a very left wing sort of economic views that could hurt us, or, you know, it could be a problem economically, let's put it that way. But I don't know that that's a diplomatic issue so much. In terms of Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, I mean, Smotrich even more than Ben-Gvir, if he's defense minister, he's also in charge of a huge part of the U.S.-Israel relationship. You know, they're constantly, Gantz is constantly flying to Washington and going to the Pentagon and everything.
Right.
And will Smotrich be welcome in those halls? It's really not so clear how that will work. With Ben-Gvir, I was always saying, you know, like, how often does the public security minister really meet with his American counterpart? You know, it doesn't happen that much. And I think that would be sort of easy for people to get around. I think if the U.S. decides that they don't want to talk to Smotrich, which at this point, my understanding is they're still kind of thinking about it, that will be really difficult with the defense ministry. And of course, it's not just the U.S. I mean, there's countries all over the world. I think, like, in Europe, like, you will have the usual suspects criticizing Israel, but, like, they have very similar things taking place in their own countries, a lot of them. And so, you know, like, I think that there's not going to be, like, an automatic response of, like, oh, you have a right-wing extremist in your government, we're not going to talk to him. Rather, it'll be, like, responses to specific actions he may or may not take.
On the other hand, right, when you think about what policies they might want to do, and you think about the defense ministry, in addition to the relationship with the United States, the defense minister is also basically the sovereign over the West Bank, over the territories. Anything that happens there, from building settlements to building Palestinian cities, security coordination between the IDF and the Palestinian security forces, all the civil administration, the coordinator of government activities in the territories, like, this is now going to be Smotrich.
Yes. And most of those things you mentioned will continue to be Smotrich. But interestingly, one of the things Smotrich has asked for in coalition negotiations is for control of the settlements to be moved to normal government control and not the IDF and the defense ministry,
which call de facto annexation.
Pretty much.
Explain to us why.
Okay. So Israel has a presence in the Judea and Samaria, right? Like, there are 500,000 Israelis live there. The settlements, they're only
on... presence is a good term. A nice parv term, Lahav. Nice parv
term. That's what I use, because I don't like to use the term occupation.
No.
Unless it's specifically talking about certain military things. But anyway, it's 500,000 Israelis. The truth is that it's only about 3% of what's considered the West Bank, but either way... And the reason that Israel never passed a law or anything to annex it the way that it did with Jerusalem and the Golan, or Eastern Jerusalem and the Golan. But if you are applying regular Israeli law instead of military government, then you're just considering it you're treating it like a regular part of Israel. So what's the difference, right? Just because you didn't say the word annexation, or you didn't say the word extending sovereignty, which is now like the preferred center through right-wing term for it.
Right.
Yeah.
Although Netanyahu, you know, could pass a bill, he could pass a bill with this coalition to annex the territory. Like, I mean, how was the Golan Heights annexed by Menachem Begin? How was the East Jerusalem, how do we apply Israeli law?
This is fun trivia for our listeners, that the entire Golan annexation was passed in one day, and at the time it was the fastest law to ever be passed. But anyway, yeah, he could. I don't think he will. If he didn't do it under Trump, like, why would he do it under Biden?
Because he didn't have this coalition under Trump, and he has it under Biden.
Yeah, but I think it wasn't just because he didn't. He had a majority. He didn't have this coalition, but he did have a majority in favor, and he didn't do it because he ran into opposition within the Trump administration.
Right.
And the opposition will be even greater from the Biden administration.
We have a great interview on this week's podcast with Yossi Klein Halevi, who's a senior fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor, and the author also of Like Dreamers, which both of us read and we liked a lot, Lahav. But he also, one of his books is called Memoirs of a Jewish Extremist, and it tells his own story of how he was attracted as a teenager to Jewish militancy and basically to Rev Meir Kahana. So we spoke to Yossi kind of about how you fall into that, and then how do you break away from it, and what are the lessons potentially for what's happening right now. But before we go to the Yossi Klein Halevi interview, I did want to get your take on the Rav Tao story. To our listeners who don't know, bit inside baseball here in Israel, but Rav Tao is a very prominent national religious rabbi. He is Yisrael Tzvi Yisrael Tao, sorry, is the rabbi and the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Amor.
It's like the ultra conservative
right.
branch, I would
Chardal, as they would be called, Haredi Leumi. Yeah,
of religious Zionism.
And the spiritual leader, so-called, of the Noam faction of the religious Zionist party, that is the very anti-gay member of Knesset who's now getting in. Avi Maoz, I think is his name. And a number of women have come forward now claiming that this man, who's in his 80s, sexually assaulted and even raped them over periods of decades. And this is now coming out. The police have decided to open a probe, but it was a bit sketchy the whole way this story came out, right, Lahav?
Well, there was a woman who wrote a Facebook post, I think, over the summer, and it didn't get a lot of attention. And then she started to protest outside the Knesset. And I think that's when people started paying attention to her. And she said that the assault occurred, or the alleged assault occurred, I believe it was 13 years ago. And then just the night before we're recording this, there was an interview in the news with someone who talked about things that Rav Tao did to her, like in the 1970s, I believe it was. So this has been going on for decades. And I think there's two sort of notable things when it comes to Rav Tao, which is that, first of all, at least in recent years, he has been a very prominent defender of other prominent religious men who were accused of sexual harassment and assault. So, you know, I don't understand why someone who has secrets of his own would put himself in the forefront of such an issue. But I guess we all know where his feelings come from about it. And then the other thing is, you mentioned Noam is the sort of homophobic party. And it's true, but it's like broader than that, right? They feel that the quote unquote normal family is under threat. So it's also like anti-feminist. And, you know, if this is someone who wants people to have normal families, I don't think this is the behavior of a normal family man.
To say the least. My problem with this whole story is that it's the story. And I don't know, he might be innocent, he might be guilty. That's up to the police and the legal system. But it's the same story over and over again with some of these rabbis who get caught and accusations are leveled against for sexual assault, whether it's against men or against women. We remember Mati Eilon, who was a very famous rabbi in the national religious sector. We know, I mean, just recently there was the Chaim Walder author. There was the Meshi Zahav, head of Zaka. There was the Kopolovich rabbi from a very famous high school in Jerusalem. You know, you mentioned Rabbi Lanner in New York, who in NCSY
Jersey,
and other schools.
Yeah, also. I mean,
it's and there's always a bit of a cover up, right? It's always like the old boys club can come together and take care of their own. Maybe they can discipline them, or maybe they can take care of the situation and send them off to exile somewhere. That happened with Mati Eilon. And apparently, according to one of the complainer, the complaints against Rav Tao, it also happened with Tao. He was kicked out of Yeshivat Merkaz Arav after one of the women complained decades ago, but then he came back. And it's like, no, you can't deal with this. It's time for the rabbinic leadership to realize they're not able to deal with it. That's why there's a police and a justice ministry. That's why there's the prosecution. Stop trying to deal with it on your own. It's not working.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the positive that I see is that what they call themselves Forum Takana, which is like the rabbis who are supposed to be like a safe space for Orthodox women to turn to. They range from like the more liberal to the more conservative end, and they are for going to the police. But they sort of take this attitude of like the woman has to make the decision, like they're not, or whoever's complaining. In the case of Mati Eilon, it was men. You know, they don't feel like they can take that action for the victim.
I see too often these cases. I mean, there was just a case recently in the elementary school that I went to back in Chicago, Ari Crown Hebrew Day School, where there was a rabbi who, back in 2010, there was a complaint leveled against him. They just fired him, but the rabbi said, "Don't do anything, don't publicize anything." And a couple years later, he happened to die. The school even held his funeral at the school. And now, recently, more complaints have come out of even worse crimes against kids. So now it's like, why couldn't you have published this years ago, given people the opportunity to come out with their with what had happened and with their trauma to deal with it? And even on the letter, by the way, listen to this absurdity, Lahav. On the letter that the school sent out, it put at the top that you can only share this within the school community. It can't, it's usher, they wrote, to spread it, to send it to people outside. I mean, are they for real? So there's a cover up now on the cover up? I mean, it's time to stop. The most important thing, and I think you and I know as journalists, be transparent, come forward, tell the story, give people the opportunity to speak. Don't make them feel they have to hide in a corner.
And there need to be real consequences for abuse.
Of course.
Yeah.
On that low note, but we'll try to try to take a little higher. This is a really, I think, Lahav, one of our best interviews with Yossi Klein-Halevi, really eloquent, one of Israel's real thought leaders, very smart.
He can speak as well as he can write.
Without a doubt. And it's something to think about. I mean, I really urge you all, listen to Yossi Klein-Halevi's interview here. Decide what you decide, but this is a man who had been there, who broke away, has insight into what Meir Kahana was and Kach was, and what that means for the Israeli political system today. Here we go. So Yossi, it's great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
And we're talking because of your, one of our most prominent thought leaders today in Israel, and your, one of your books is Memoirs of a Jewish Extremist and the Story of a Transformation. And you kind of go through your story as a young teenager, your draw and attraction to the Jewish Defense League, the JDL, to Meir Kahana, and what that was like, and then the wake up that happened with it. But before we get to the wake up, and we're talking because of obviously the rise of Itamar Ben-Gvir and the far right extremists who are now going to be joining the coalition of Benjamin Netanyahu. But if you could take us back in time to the 1960s when you were coming of age and you were drawn to Meir Kahana, tell us what he was like. Like, what was the attraction?
Well, first of all, the particular moment in time is significant. It's the late 1960s, just after the Six-Day War, which brought this tremendous resurgence of Jewish pride and to some extent militancy. It was also the moment when my generation, the children of Holocaust survivors, were starting to come of age. I was in high school then, and we were starting to ask questions and about the American Jewish community and about its silence during the Holocaust. There was this sense of great rage that my generation was carrying, and we were looking for some way to express it. And it was also the 1960s when political violence and rage were rewarded by media attention and became really part of American culture. And finally, and this was really, I'd say, the catalyst for me in particular, and what drew me to Kahana, was the Soviet Jewry movement. I had been an activist in the peaceful wing of the Soviet Jewry protest movement, which was just coming of age with the post-Six-Day War period, with the rise of the refuseniks in the Soviet Union. And that also, that had a galvanizing impact on my friends and I and our generation. So really, if you put all of these very heady factors together, what you get is an explosion of anger, of in the memoirs book that you mentioned, I call it the ecstasy of rage, because that was also the American 60s, the sense of joy in being able to go into the streets and be part of something greater. So Kahana was really playing on both Jewish themes, post-Holocaust, post-Six-Day War, Soviet Jewry, but also very American themes, you know, Easy Rider and that whole late 60s culture, which Kahana brilliantly manipulated and brought together with Jewish militancy.
So what was your involvement in the movement and sort of how close were you to Rabbi Kahana?
Well, first of all, I was never part of the inner circle, and there was always something in me that was wary of Kahana. I remember, for example, being very upset about the alliance that he formed with Joe Colombo, who was the head of one of the mafia families. And he did it because Colombo offered him legal aid and all kinds of other assistance in exchange for the supposed legitimacy that Mayor Kahana conferred on the mafia. And I felt sullied by Kahana's alliance with Joe Colombo. And I saw in that a fatal attraction to violence. I think Kahana was in love with the mafia because he was in love with violence. And in some ways his motto should have been, you know, why solve any problem peacefully when you can try violence first? And I think that was his default position, but it was also something deeper. There was this expedience, a cynicism about means and ends, that if your ends are noble, then all means are permitted to you. So I was never part of his inner circle, but I had a push and pull attraction. I was there. I was part of the JDL. I participated in starting with the sit downs, and then it escalated. I participated in attacks on Soviet cultural events, and then moved on to considering real violence. I was very much pulled in that direction, and it was only circumstances that kept me from being involved in activities that could have ruined my life.
I like how in the book you mention, you know, we spoke about this before, but jokingly, of how reviewers said they were a bit disappointed that you weren't a real terrorist. You were just a militant,
right. A failed terrorist.
But Yossi, I am curious, you know, your parents were both Holocaust survivors, or just your father?
Just my father. Yeah.
Just your father, and from Hungary, and obviously great trauma. But, you know, as a son of Holocaust survivors, and I'm wondering if that wasn't also maybe part of it, right? The fact that here was a rabbi, a Jewish American who was standing up for Jews.
Absolutely.
Who was fighting, who was active, who wasn't being silent, right? Was that part? Like, I think here also, it's like kind of...
Oh, it was crucial. It was crucial. Look, when we used to chant the JDL slogan, Never Again, we didn't mean that never again would there be another Holocaust, because that wasn't in our control. And I think we understood that. But what we meant was never again would Jews be silent when other Jews were facing death. And so the never again of the JDL was actually aimed internally at the Jewish community. It was aimed at the Jewish leaders who had failed to rescue European Jewry. And here was Kahana standing up, and he sounded like my father. Yeah. And there was no Jewish leader who had that rage and that kind of self-recrimination. And I remember he used to speak at rallies about how when Blacks were denied the right to sit in the front of the bus, they took to the streets and they were arrested en masse. And he said, when Jews were being murdered by the millions, American Jews went basically about their business. Now, in retrospect, I think that critique was unfair. It was World War II. Most young American Jews were in uniform. This was still an immigrant or post-immigrant community. There was tremendous anti-Semitism in America. But all of that That was a context that I began to understand only later. At the time, Kahana expressed this raw sense of rage and betrayal that my generation, the second generation, felt toward American Jewry. And Kahana was our spokesman.
So what was the turning point for you? Like, when did you decide that you are no longer going to be in this group of people? I mean, you said you were disappointed in the mafia ties, but that it continued after that.
Yeah, it did continue. And, you know, Kahana moved to Israel in 1971. And we went to the airport to see him off, and we danced and sang and ripped up flags of communist countries that were hanging in JFK and in the main terminal in those years. That's how we kind of celebrated Kahana's aliyah.
Sounds like what some of the Ben-Gvir youth do today when they burn, you know, rip up flags, but okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of overlap between who we were and who they were, with one big exception. We were a minority that was just coming, living in a non-Jewish country, and we were just coming to terms with the Holocaust. Ben-Gvir's followers are living in a sovereign Jewish state protected by the IDF, and yet are acting as if we're living in a besieged ghetto, and we need to create militias and vigilante groups. But to answer your question, Lahav, when Kahana moved to Israel, he began to change his focus, his political focus, away from the Soviet Jewry cause, which is why I joined with him in the first place, and moving more toward what would become his anti-Arab campaign, advocating the mass expulsion, not only of Palestinians, but of Arab-Israeli citizens. But it took a while, I think, for us in America, for his teenage followers to internalize this. And the moment that I began to realize that something was changing in the agenda was when I came to Israel in the summer of 1973. I was here for my junior year abroad program at Hebrew University. And Kahana was running for the Knesset. It was his first campaign. And I volunteered. I went to the JDL office on Jaffa Street in Jerusalem and offered my to participate. And I began realizing that Kahana was speaking a totally different language than he had in the States. In the States, it really was about protecting vulnerable Jews, whether in the Soviet Union or Jews in what were called then changing neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods that were becoming unsafe for Jews. And Kahana would organize street patrols. And so those were the areas that had really attracted me. And I was not interested in following Kahana into the farthest corner of the Israeli right. And then when the Yom Kippur War came, just about a month or so after I came to Israel, Kahana became I would say, a lunatic. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it. Kahana began speaking in apocalyptic terms. The whole world is against us. We need to throw ourselves on God's mercy and show that we have no fear of the Gentile. And to do that, we need to blow up the Dome of the Rock and expel all the Palestinians. In other words, provoke the entire Muslim world into a holy war against us and to ensure that we would be completely friendless in the world. That became Kahana's apocalyptic and messianic agenda. Mm-hmm. And if you read his writing after the Yom Kippur War, especially his book, 40 Years, which he wrote in an Israeli prison, you see that he shifted from becoming a political ideologue, which is how I knew him in the States, to becoming a theologian. Kahana was no longer a political activist. He became an apocalyptic racist theologian, and he created right. his own version of Judaism that centralized vengeance, hatred, and rage against the non-Jewish world as the core of the purpose of the Jewish people.
So, Yossi, I'm curious, you know, if we move now to where we are today, one of the things that I get asked often is, you know, Ben-Gvir, why is he so bad? You know, other people have said this in the past. Lieberman people refer to as, you know, an example about loyalty questions and things like that. But the one thing that kind of stands out to me is just looking at them and knowing this ideology that you just very eloquently told us of where kind of it's rooted in, they simply have a very different vision of what it means to live in this country and what happens to minorities and what happens to people. I mean, do you see this type of messianic danger in the modern manifestation of Kahana? Let's call him Itamar Ben-Gvir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, Ben-Gvir's genius was to basically borrow a page out of the playbook of the European far right, people like Marine Le Pen, the new prime minister in Italy, the Swedish former neo-Nazi party that's just emerged as the second largest party in Sweden of all countries. And Ben-Gvir learned that you need to downplay the overt racism. And so what he did was, I mean, my reading of Ben-Gvir's move, and I don't know whether this was conscious or not on his part, was to reactivate the Mayor Kahana of America, the Mayor Kahana before he moved to Israel, who spoke about defending Jewish lives, and he was the protector of the Jewish people rather than espousing racism and insane apocalyptic fantasies. Ben-Gvir toned all of that down and so managed to repackage himself as a more hard-line version of Netanyahu, but essentially still within the broad Israeli right-wing mainstream. I don't trust that for a moment. And one of the reasons I don't trust it is because I know how Kahana used to operate. In the States, he would create these front groups he would try to attract people who were a little bit afraid of the JDL, didn't want to necessarily associate directly with Kahana, but wanted to be activists. And so Kahana would create one front group after another. None of them were really successful in the end. But that's very much a radical mindset, which of course Kahana borrowed from the Communist Party of the 1930s and 40s. The Soviet Union used to set up these front groups all over the world, peace fronts, and, you know, for people who were unwilling to join the Communist Party, but became fellow travelers. And so what Ben-Gvir has very cleverly done, I think, is turn himself and his whole movement into a front group. And what lurks behind there is an agenda that aims at turning Arab Israelis into conditional citizens. This, you know, Ben-Gvir spoke recently at the memorial
for Kahana, right?
For Kahana, and what he said was, "I'm no longer in favor of expelling all the Arabs." Now, he was booed there, but pay attention to that language. "I'm no longer in favor of expelling all the Arabs." What he's doing here is changing Israeli discourse because, well, okay, it's not necessarily legitimate to advocate expelling all the Arabs, but some of the Arabs. And again, we're not talking here about Palestinians. We're talking about citizens of Israel. Ben-Gvir is now creating a new category of Israeli citizen, potential expellees. And this is something that really goes back to Kahana. And it's interesting because Kahana, in 1973, didn't run for his first Knesset campaign on a platform advocating wholesale expulsion, indiscriminate expulsion of Palestinians and Arab Israelis. What he said was, we need to voluntarily encourage the emigration of Arab Israelis. And Ben-Gvir said something similar the other week, and it was almost completely unnoted in the Israeli media. But I thought that was an extraordinary moment when he said that we need to be creating an office to voluntarily encourage people to emigrate. And this is what I sense is stirring beneath the supposed transformation of Ben-Gvir.
So there's another side to Ben-Gvir of discrimination against Jews. I mean, he wants to make the laws of Aliyah much, much stricter and really considers reform and possibly also conservative Jews not to be legitimate Jews. Did Kahana talk about that as well? If he did, I'm less familiar with it.
Not the American Kahana. The Israeli Kahana, absolutely. The Israeli Kahana banished entire groups from within the Jewish people as being illegitimate Jews, Hebrew-speaking Gentiles and traitors and sellouts. There were whole categories.
It was kind of amazing that someone who was advocating for Soviet Jewry, who we know so many of them are not Jewish according to halakha, but still identify Jewishly, was also, you know, is against them in a different way.
Yeah, but again, bear in mind that there are two stages to Kahana. The American Kahana never made these distinctions. And the Israeli Kahana began gradually, it didn't happen right away, began identifying whole groups as enemies of the Jewish, groups within the Jewish people as enemies and as inauthentic Jews. And certainly the purity of the Jewish people needed to be maintained at all costs. But that became part of the theological apocalyptic Kahana.
Yossi, just one last question before we let you go. What needs to happen, in your opinion, for Israelis who supported Ben-Gvir to undergo the transformation? It's obviously different, but you know, the transformation you went through, or for them to wake up and realize this is not maybe what's right for Israel. Or, I mean, listen, they might be right. Maybe it is right for Israel. Time will tell. But
well, look, there are two categories here. There's the hardcore, the ideologues. And then there are the people, the vast majority, who were not voting for racist reasons, were voting because they are afraid, legitimately so. We're in a new wave of terrorism. And last year's riots in the mixed Arab-Jewish Israeli cities like Lod were traumatic. And that's what Ben-Gvir is feeding on. And I think that there will be a gradual wake up when people begin to realize that Ben-Gvir's transformation is a deception. It's a con job. He tweeted the other day that he intends to try to implement an official commemoration for Mayor Kahana, who was no less an important leader of the Jewish people than Yitzhak Rabin.
Right.
Now, what he's doing there is equating an assassinated Israeli prime minister with the leader of the camp from which the assassin emerged. And we have never seen anything like this kind of language before in a mainstream Israeli political discourse. This is the far fringes of Israel being brought into the heart of the Israeli establishment.
The security cabinet, the police ministry, you name it. Yes.
Yeah. We have our incoming prime minister to thank for that, as well as for so many other gifts he's about to bestow on the people of Israel, like greater subsidies for yeshiva students than for soldiers. There's going to be a whole host of very unpleasant surprises that Ben-Gvir and the other coalition partners are going to be imposing on us. And so if you're asking about how the wake-up is going to happen, I think that mainstream Israelis are going to realize, wait a minute, this isn't what we signed up for. Mm-hmm. And as far as the hardcore goes, and I can, you know, personally, I can identify with the hardcore, that's a very slow process. It's an individual process. It's a whole conversation in itself. Some are able to go through it, some partially, some not at all. But really right now, I'm looking at, my hope is that the very large numbers of Israelis who I think innocently, to some extent, voted for Ben-Gvir will be disillusioned enough to realize that they need to find another political home. And that will bring Itamar Ben-Gvir back to his natural constituency, which is the farthest right.
Yossi, this has been a very sobering, but also extremely important. So we thank you for your time and your insight. And thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. Please recommend us to your family and friends. They can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you like to listen to podcasts, all the major platforms. And we will be back next week.